This is David Newbold. This is Porch Talk, and we're here in my backyard carport in Nashville, Tennessee, 6 feet apart. And this is called The Long Road to Barstow. Those songs out of a bottle, they were my only hope, but I'll be damned if I didn't drink them down to the last note. Falling off a bar stool was all that I ever did. I never gave a damn, I just never had a damn to give. Another boozy night going nowhere. I hit the gas, but I was moving slow. There's something in the road or something in the air that made me feel it was time to go. Pick me up and lead me down the long road to Barstow. Sunrise in my review, bass drum in my head. I had a heart full of sorrow and a right foot full of lead. And a radiator leaking, a crack in the grill. It was another night of drinking and mixing in the pills. Well, I don't remember too much after midnight, but I heard it like an echo in my soul. But I couldn't turn around, no, I couldn't face the light. I couldn't suffer what I didn't know. Pick me up and lead me down the long road to Barstow. Death Valley Motor Inn. Well, I'd parked around the bag before I stumbled on in to my $30 room. I put the smoke to the fire, and peeling back the curtains, I saw the blood on the tiles. Another boozy night going nowhere. But I was moving slow. I feel it in my bones. They are gonna find me, Lord. Who sent me to the devil down below? Pick me up and lead me down the road. Oh, pick me up, lead me down the road. Where I'm hiding out, driving down. David Newbold. And so we're just going to start with, man, just where you're from and growing up. And just what did that look like? You're originally from Canada, right?
From Toronto.
Toronto.
That's right, yeah.
And so growing up, man, like just earliest memories of, you know, music. Was it mom and dad's records or just in the car? What did that look like?
Earliest was probably my dad and I would go out driving. He used to like to try to get me into playing golf. And we'd go to his golf courses that he liked, and we would listen to Jim Croce in the car. And I dug me some Jim Croce when I was a kid. And that's probably one of the first memories I have. My folks' record collection wasn't really something that, you know, even now when I look back at it, it still hasn't aged well to me.
yeah.
I can say that. But, Top 40 radio, when I was about 9, was the first time I became cognizant of, like, pop music, you know, current, you know, rock and roll. I don't know, even at the time, if it was, I mean, I used to listen to the Casey Kasem Top 40, and I remember the song Come On Eileen,
uh-huh.
And that was like the first one that
Come
I heard.
Come On Eileen.
Yeah, and I was like, to me, that was always my my sort of Beatles on Ed Sullivan moment.
Yeah.
You know, not quite as seismic to the world, but to me,
yeah,
it really was. And I used to start listening, waiting all the time for that song to come on, and then all the other songs at the time. And, you know, that was probably the first thing. That and the Jim Croce car rides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so just, I guess, growing up in Canada and, like, being immersed with, I guess, you know, the United States sound, were there any just Canadian standouts early in your life that kind of stood out, that kind of helped pave the way for you?
I don't know about paved the way, but I mean, I was definitely into Bryan Adams at that time. This was early first half of the 80s, maybe.
Yeah.
So, you know, Cuts Like a Knife and stuff like that. And my mom took me to see him in concert when I was, I don't know, 10, 11, something like that. And, you know, I was cognizant of the fact that he was Canadian. I mean, Canadian radio had and still has a CanCon rules, Canadian content law, which means that I think it's 33% of everything they play has to be Canadian.
Oh, wow.
So there was, lots of, you know, I mean, Gordon Lightfoot, of course, actually. My folks are fans of Gordon Lightfoot, so I got to give him credit for that. He's Canadian, so I knew about that. And there were lots of Canadian bands at the time that were really big and that, you know, probably wasn't until years later when I moved to this country that I realized a lot of the things I grew up on seemed like universal things, were kind of Canadian, mm-hmm. insulated bands, like, you know, April Wine was one, Kim Mitchell.
Okay.
People that were just huge stars in Canada, selling out arenas,
mm-hmm.
Canadian only. Very, very omnipresent on the radio and TV there and then, though.
Yeah, sure. And so how old were you when you started picking up the guitar?
So, I was probably about 14.
Yep.
I actually started on the drums. Started on the piano when I was younger. I took piano lessons. Got into drums was my first kind of individual excursion.
Okay.
And
was the piano, was that going to be like classically trained lessons? Or?
Yeah, it was reading music. It was like lessons you take when you're a kid, learning theory and
yeah.
all that. Reading, learning songs, off sheet music. And then got into drums, built my own drum kit with frisbees, trash can lids, got one drum, eventually got another drum, eventually built a kit. Come high school, I had friends that played guitar. They would come over with their guitars and amps and we would jam. And they started leaving their gear over so they wouldn't have to cart it back and forth every time. And I started picking up their guitars while they were gone. And it was a very short switchover. Mm-hmm. I'd say within about 3 months, I'd pretty much abandoned drums and decided guitar
had all
was going to be it.
Yeah,
yeah. I don't know why. I felt I enjoyed the hell out of drums. I guess I felt like more instinctively proficient on the guitar, I guess, than the drums.
Yeah.
But you know, Alex Van Halen and Eddie Van Halen started the opposite too. Alex was the guitar player and Eddie was the drummer.
I didn't know that.
And Alex started playing the drums and he got better than Eddie really quick. And Eddie said, well, I guess I may as well play the guitar.
And did he? So like, man, like as you were just starting to learn how to play guitar, who were some of those influences as you got more proficient on it that you were kind of looking to as far as influence?
It was, you know, Jimi Hendrix, Jimmy Page.
Oh, yeah.
Neil Young a little bit later. Tony Iommi. I was really into classic rock at the time. So it was all those guys, Mark Knopfler, Eddie Van Halen. You know, I really just wanted to play guitar as loud and, I don't know, I just was really into that. Pete Townsend, that was it. Just the great guitar players. Wasn't really digging too deep at the time, 14, 15. I was kind of just coming into learning all about the classic rock guys, so.
Right. And so as you were getting older, just in high school and coming out, was a lot of bands in your youth there, or what did that look like?
There was some. There was three bands in our high school that I remember that we used to play club shows with, and every year at like the talent show, our bands would play. There was a band called the Rustic Gomers, named after like Gomer Pyle. There was a band called Blue Planet, and they were kind of like the hippie jam band. And then the band that I had with my friends called Rock Bottom. And and there were other bands of like some older kids, like we were 10th grade, 11th grade, and of course there were some seniors, 12th grade, at that time there was still grade 13 in Ontario too. Some of the older kids had bands that seemed amazing to me. Mm-hmm. They played really well. Don't remember their names. But yeah, there was a few of us bands, and we would play some shows at clubs, and I wouldn't say there was a big scene, and I was never like a real social scene. Like I had my small group of friends, and that were it. That was it. And these other guys, like the hippie band, obviously, every time they would play, there'd be like 75, 100 kids show up to them.
Oh yeah.
My buddy Pat Cook, I'm still friends with. He was the guy in that band, yeah, you know. But we started playing clubs in Toronto, just trying to get something going, and you know, it's hard to, at that time, create a vision for what, you know. I knew I wanted to make a living at it and be successful, but I didn't know
what it looked like.
The steps. I was just like, let's just try to get some gigs. And then,
yeah,
you know, I mean, I guess that's how everybody starts, right? So we just played around. But it's hard to keep bands together because not everyone's as focused in high school as I was necessarily. And
right. You had, you had relationships, and then people were making plans to go to school, and then work and or whatever else it could be, right?
Or just hanging out with their friends, and not everyone would want to rehearse all the time. And the drummer we had was the same. He was as focused as me, for sure. But in high school, I don't know, everyone's just going every which way, you know. I wasn't, but most kids do. Most people do. It's just normal. It's hard to find a pack like that. And even the other bands, they all seemed to me to have the same balance of how much it meant to them versus how much everything else meant to them, which is why it worked. You know, I wouldn't say that I felt like those guys were as dedicated to careers in it, but they all seemed to have the same level of it. So they would kind of rehearse when they all felt the need to, and they would, you know, it seemed to be harmonious. For me, it was always trying to get people as
kind
of, yeah, driven into it as I was.
Yeah. And so, coming out of high school and just up into the late teenage years, early 20s, how long would it be before you made your way down here to the Nashville scene?
To Nashville? Oh, several stops along.
If I'm skipping too far ahead, yeah. So yeah. What about just coming to America, I guess?
Yeah, I first I started going down to New York City.
Okay.
Right out of high school. When I was finished.
What was going on there? What was you doing?
Well, it was all brand new. I mean, I didn't know anybody except for some second cousins I had that lived there. I stayed with them for about a week, and I just tried to I just kind of wanted to start my life there. I don't know. By that time, I was sort of burnt out on Toronto. Mm-hmm. You know, the bands I had it all broken up. I wasn't really the music there was. It felt insulated to me at the time, and I wanted to like take on the world. You know, mm-hmm. New York City just seemed to be the place, and all my heroes had gone right through there. So I felt like, what choice did I have? So I just went down there and started meeting people. I met a dude who also was from Canada, and he had a band. So the first thing I did was start playing guitar in his band called mm-hmm. The Mercenaries. And I did that for a few years. I wasn't really writing any songs. I'm just playing guitar. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of immersed myself in New York. This was early 90s. So it was kind of all about connecting with the history of all the people that I grew up at, you know, admiring and wanting to follow in their footsteps, and it was kind of creating my own path. Mm-hmm. Learning all about different music that I was, you know, unfamiliar with.
And just as in a city as big as New York, finding those music pockets, at first, was it hard to find that pocket?
And you those know, people? I spent about a week walking around, just starting to kind of discover the place, and I walked by Electric Lady Studios, because like I told you, I was a big Jimi Hendrix fan. Mm-hmm. And I knocked on the door to see if anyone would let me in. They wouldn't let me in. So I crossed the street, and there was a record store there. So I just went into the record store, and they had some flyers on the wall for people advertising for bands and stuff. And there was a guy who said he was looking for a guitar player, and he was into Bob Dylan and The Replacements, and that might have been all it said. So I took the number and I called the guy, mm-hmm. and it was as easy as that. And we went and met, and he was like, "Yeah, I'm from Canada." I said, "I'm from Canada," and he was older than me by about 6 years, and he seemed to have it going on. He'd been there about a year, so he seemed to be dug in. And he had some cassettes that he recorded with his band. Mm-hmm. And I guess their guitar player had left. I don't remember why he needed a guitar player. So I just showed up with my guitar. No, I didn't even have an electric guitar at that time. Before I left for New York, our house in Canada got robbed. A guy from my high school broke in. I've known who it was since it happened. Broke in, emptied the house, took all my guitars and everything. And I had a Les Paul that I'd bought on credit from a pawn shop in Toronto. Spent like 6 months paying it off. It was gold top. Les Paul custom, you know, obviously my prized possession in my life at that time.
Yeah.
Got stolen, but we got a bunch of insurance money for everything, which actually helped fund my start and go down there. So I had to buy a new, so I didn't even have a guitar then. I just showed up and started playing his guitar. I was like, yeah, I'm into all those people. And we kind of hit it off, and I dug his songs. And so I went back to Toronto. I think that was at the beginning of that summer. Went back. Saved up some money. Maybe I had to wait for that insurance money to come. I can't remember how it worked. But yeah. Anyway, in the fall, I moved down. We started going down really regularly. And that's when, then we just started playing gigs. Mm-hmm. First gig was at CBGB's. I mean, that was cool.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Whole documentary on that now.
It was just a place on posters, you know, that I had on like, you know, punk band posters and stuff on the wall. And so that was it. I remember the first time I went out and hung out with them. We went down to CB's and some other clubs, and it just felt like the first night of the rest of my life, you know.
Right.
Had that feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like this is the beginning of riding the lightning right here.
That was it. Yeah.
And so, man, just like from New York there, how much time was spent like for the rest of your stay there in New York?
It totaled almost transition. 9 years. Totaled almost 9 years. I stayed there. This is, you know, I don't know how who's interested in how many details. I stay there. You know, New York City's very famous for a lot of people go there. They spend around a year. Like Levon said, you know, it kicks your ass and you leave, and then you come back and try it again. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened after about 8-9 months. I was kind of burnt out because, you know, we were working day jobs. It was also out of high school. This was the first time I was working full-time jobs too, and that was grinding me down, just because New York's a grind, you know, making very little money, living hand to mouth. I mean, it's kind of romantic in a certain way, but the gigs were kind of few and far between, and after a while, I was like, this isn't happening, you know, yeah. I gotta try something else. So I went out to California. I just thought, San Francisco, that's gonna be where it's at. So I packed all my shit, got on the train, took the 3-day train out to San Francisco, moved into a international hostel there.
Yeah.
Started trying to put a band together. Ended up street busking with a guy, and that ended up being what I did for a few months. And that didn't really, I don't know, I got kind of disillusioned with that after a while too. I thought, how the hell am I going to do this? What's the plan going to be? And then I kind of bailed. I was feeling pressure from my family to go to college because I had applied for colleges and got into some, and I put it, you know, whatever they call it when you put it off for a year, deferred. I did that. I said, okay, I'm going to go back to Canada. Like, this is, I'm out of money. I don't have a band. My songs, I'd started writing songs. They were, you know, they weren't very good.
Uh-huh.
I just couldn't put it all together. So I went back to Canada, to New Brunswick, which is on top of Maine. Spent 2 years going to school there. Had a good time. And then I started putting it all together while I was up there. I just realized this is not right. You know, I was doing well. I was becoming really independent. But it kind of crystallized more like, no, I need to be playing with these guys back in New York. I really realized how much I loved those songs and those dudes and that band, and mm-hmm. It was no time not to do it. So I went back down after 2 years and ended up staying for about 5 or 6 years. Ended up leaving the band after a year or two because I started having all my own songs, lots of them, and I just
started believing more in your process. Exactly. And your songwriting.
And by now I'm like 22, 23, so, you know, I'm feeling more confident in doing that. So I stayed, I'd say when I went back, it was about another almost 6 years. And you know, it kind of came and went. The curve flattened, as one might say in these current times. This is March 21st, 2020. We're sitting here 6 feet apart wearing gloves. Yeah. Trying to keep the curves flat, Alan and I, right now.
That's it.
Curve flattened, and I picked Austin, Texas. I said, now I'm going to move to Austin, Texas. You know, at that age, you just move somewhere. You don't know anybody. You just think, I'm going to start a new chapter. You just do it.
Yeah.
You know, so I just did that. And that's what I did then. And then I was there for about 7 or 8 years before I came here.
Yeah. And so just that music scene in Austin, I haven't been out that way for music at all, but it seems like it's a better place to kind of raise and nurture a songwriter person, I guess, if that makes any sense. I mean, I know historically there's a lot of great songwriters coming out of that area, and I guess just the bars and the pubs and the places to play, it's more open to that, if that makes sense. I don't know if that's real.
Than New York City?
Or
than a lot of places? Or
than New York, yeah.
You know, I there were a lot of bands. When I first moved down there, I was surprised at how many bands there were versus just singer-songwriters. There were a lot of singer-songwriters, which was cool because I was always in bands, and I never really wanted to be the solo singer-songwriter guy. I always like having a band.
Mm-hmm. You
know, I like them both, but Texas has a very rich history of some of the greatest songwriters ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, New York City's produced, you know, Lou Reed, and, you know, Carole King, people like that. My heroes that went through New York City went there. Like I did.
Yeah, they did.
Bob Dylan,
that.
Neil Young, Springsteen, he was close, but still, you know, they weren't New Yorkers. Texas produces great songwriters and musicians that are Texans. So that's the difference.
Yeah.
And it's an easier, it's a slower pace of life. I mean, just about anywhere is a slower pace of life than New York City, certainly anywhere on this continent.
Sure.
you feel like there's more time to develop things. People live there, they don't leave.
Yeah.
People go to New York, they stay for a while, they leave.
Yeah.
With rare exceptions. The only friends I still have up there are the ones that grew up there. They were born there.
Yeah.
So, it's in the air, it's in the water in Texas, because it's people that just go out. You go out on a random night, see someone playing. It's been playing there for 40 years.
Yeah.
Not necessarily at that club, but in Austin.
Yeah.
Touring Texas.
Yeah, he's held that scene down. He's been a part of that scene for some time. Yeah.
Who's that?
I mean, just those cats.
Oh, when you see somebody, yeah, right. It's like there was a guy, W.C. Clark, I remember. I remember a girl I was hanging out with took me to see W.C. Clark. That's cool. Old blues guy.
Mm-hmm.
Really great. You know, find out he goes back to, like, 70s there, I think. And, you know, the credentials you find, connections, relations that he had.
Yeah.
Are rich in history, you know. I remember playing at a club, and there was an old guy in a wheelchair. The club was empty. It was way up in North Austin, like on a weeknight. There was a bartender, a few regulars, and this old guy in a wheelchair, just sitting there. Played to them. Found out at the end of the night it was Pine Top Perkins.
Wow.
Yeah. That's like where he hung out.
They give you any kind of a review?
He didn't really talk. Not really. He talked. I went up to him after. So he just sort of said, "Thanks for playing." You know.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, learning about Willie Nelson, understanding it, you know, I didn't get it. Where I came from, country music was kind of a joke, I hate to say.
Yeah.
You know, songwriters was just the person in the band who wrote the cool riffs.
Yeah.
And the lyrics was all about cool lines.
Yeah, hooks. Yeah.
Hooks are just like a line that sounded cool, you know. There was a great band in Canada at the time in Toronto called The Phantoms I really liked, and they had cool songs. They seemed like advanced to me for that, for what was going on at the time. In Texas, learning about Willie, I didn't take Willie Nelson seriously when I grew up. I mean, can you believe that? Like, I'm ashamed to say it.
I didn't either.
I didn't get it.
I didn't know.
I didn't understand why his voice.
A lot of those cats that come from that era, I remember just, you know, being young and riding with my dad. At, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, it was cool because it's what my dad listened to. But when I was teenage, 15, 16, you know, I would hear that come on or somebody play it and be like, "You serious?
Yeah.
Of all the things you want to play on your radio, you going to play this? Of everything." And now, like, looking back, I just want to, you know, it's like, that's good stuff, man.
Well, it just wasn't in the air. You know, there would have been people. There would have been people that had discovered that up there, but I didn't know any of those people. You know.
Yeah.
I didn't know why Willie Nelson's voice was an instrument, why it like carried the Texas wind within itself. You know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the great country singers, you know, we would all have nicknames for them, like Conway Twitt. You know, or like, I'm trying to think of some others. You know, it was all just a joke.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I'm the biggest country fan in the world, but I mean, it's a serious art form in its original versions. And a lot of that comes from Texas.
Yeah, I guess is what they call outlaw country now. It's the roots of country.
Sure, yeah. I mean, a lot of those guys, yeah, I mean, I'm a big Jerry Jeff Walker fan, but he was a migrant to Texas from upstate New York. But sure, Waylon, yeah. Obviously, those guys. I didn't understand any of that. But I do now, and I do from Texas. Towns, obviously, Towns Van Zandt. Like, I don't think I'd ever even heard of him before that. Guy Clark.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an education. That was a serious education, where all of a sudden I felt like songs had to, they were layered. I mean, Bob Dylan songs are layered, and Springsteen songs are layered, and, you know, they're still two of my absolute favorites. But that was abstract to me. Like, I didn't know, I didn't understand, I didn't know where that came from. I wasn't really big into literature beyond the things that I liked, you know. I didn't, you know, I was never like, I never knew much about religion to use, you know, its structures as metaphors and references in songs, you know. I always, like, who listens to Bob Dylan and thinks, like, I could write like that? Like, nobody. He's the only person that can sound like right like that. The people from Texas, I sort of started to understand this comes from life, directly life around them, and the generations that came before them of their family and their family friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed like a way, that seemed like a new element to work with that I hadn't really put together.
Yeah. And so, I mean, how far off are you from this point to in your songwriting, having the album put together and start recording?
I started doing that in New York. I started putting out EPs there.
So what about that, your first album here?
First album here, Tennessee?
No, like...
In the box?
Yeah.
I mean, the
not,
first...
Not Sin and Redemption, but the... what's the other one? The older one.
Well, Tennessee was the one that I did here in 2013. And then I put out an EP called The Devil Is His Name in 2016. And then Sin Redemption came out end of last year.
Okay, and then before that, we're talking New York doing EPs.
Well, in Austin, I put out a few, too. I put out an album. First full length I did was in Austin, and that was called Big Red Sun. And that was 2007, maybe.
Okay.
And I did when I left Austin, I put together a live DVD. I got funded by the Austin Music Network there and did a live DVD and a CD with all my friends from there. Before that, there'd been an EP, and then in New York, there was a couple of EPs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Starting in 98, first one, 98, three songs. But I had all this, you know. When I started writing songs, I started writing a lot of songs, and there was always a lot. And, you know, recording them was just whenever, I don't know, the first one, how I had a friend with a kind of a home studio, so I was able to do a couple songs there. There was a school called, I'm not going to say what it was called, because... It was cool. They would have people come in, artists, songwriters that wanted to record for free, and it was basically you're recording for a recording engineer teacher and a bunch of like recording engineering students. They're kind of like a guinea pig for them. So it'd be like 7 weeks. You go in 7 weekends in a row every Saturday. I think it was something like that. Spend 7 weeks recording songs for them so they could learn how to record.
Mm-hmm.
Mic, mix, all that stuff. And the guy who was the teacher was like an experienced, you know, recording engineer. Now he taught. I mean, it was recording school, you know. And then at the end, they would you basically buy the tapes from them on the DL. And so I was able to, like track songs. So I said, okay. So I was able to track them for free. The mixes that came out of it weren't great because it was just, you know, quick. And it was students. But then I was able to take the tracks to a couple of them I took to my friend's studio. One I took to a studio that a friend of mine was making a record at, and I mixed a couple of songs with that guy.
Uh-huh.
And able to somehow assemble it. He had a connection at Master Disc, I think. Like one of the big mastering companies in New York City. And so I was able to get a deal and master it into a CD. And just passed that around at gigs and sold it.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow got to a guy who ended up managing me for a few years, and then he wanted to record some new songs, so we recorded those at his home studio and tracked the drums at a friend's studio, and just piecemeal, you know.
Yeah.
You know, picked the best few songs I had at the time, and all the other ones, just nothing ever happened.
Kind of fell off to the wayside.
That's it.
Yeah. And so up to, I guess, after Austin, would Nashville come next?
Yep. Then I moved here.
So, what led you here to Nashville? Same as Austin? Just new place, new chapter?
No, well, you know, it ended up being that way. It ended up being that way. It wasn't supposed to be. It wasn't designed that way. I started touring in Texas. I didn't do any of that in New York. I wish I had now. It just wasn't possible. I didn't have a car. You know, I was just living it there. I just was working at it. I just kept feeling like if I worked hard enough in New York City, I could make something happen. I could grow out of that. I kind of wish I'd had the mindset to start touring more then, but I didn't. So when I started doing that in Texas, I got a booking agent eventually. And I was working pretty well for a couple of years, touring a lot. And then, but it was inconsistent. you know, it didn't seem like it was going to, it just seemed kind of, I don't know, it's like a stepping stone situation. And then I got a, found a booking agent who was up in this part of the country, and that guy was really into, and he had branched off from a bigger agency, so I felt pretty good about it, and I was going to start working the Southeast, and basically working a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'd wanted to come up and see about getting a publishing deal and all that stuff, too. I didn't know anything about how that worked, but I was interested in it. So I just kind of felt like I had to move here to grow my career, I guess, you know. I don't know if the reasons at the time, neither of them panned out at all. Like, instantly, the agency fell apart right when I got here. Mm-hmm. The publishing thing, I soon realized, you know, it's mostly about writing for mainstream country radio, which wasn't going to be my thing. You know, publishing companies here would buy catalogs of successful songwriters from elsewhere. Like, a lot of Texas songwriters had publishing deals here because they were writing hit songs on country radio, and, you know, they had a lot of albums that had been garnering airplay, but I wasn't really in that position, so it ended up being just starting from scratch all over again, which was kind of frustrating. You know, in hindsight, I'm glad the move was made. I wouldn't want to not be here now. The connections I've made here obviously have been great. You know, in hindsight, if I knew the way it was going to work, I might have waited a couple more years. You know, mm-hmm. My wife Kim and I, we'd started dating at that time, and I left. You know, it was kind of sudden.
Is she from Texas?
She's not from Texas, but she lived there at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, we decided, you know, eventually she moved up here, and everything worked out.
Yeah.
But it could have been smoother. Put it that way.
Right.
But all that said, you know, the level of songwriting here is another step. The level of talent here and across the board musicianship, across the board, even songs that you don't like here necessarily, those people that write them are really talented at it, really good at it. And, you know, I feel like a lot of them sort of get it. Like, they're writing those songs for country radio. Mm-hmm. But they're into a lot of the same people that you or I would be into, you know.
Yeah, that's not necessarily country.
Yeah. You know, it's like a, yeah, it's
kind
like
kind
a skill.
Kind of
panhandling like,
to the scene.
Like, maybe you can cook all kinds of food great, but you're in a place where there's a shortage of great taco chefs. Mm-hmm. So you learn how to make the best tacos, and you end up supporting your family by being that somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
But you can make curry. You can make all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of that.
Yeah.
So.
And so up to the Tennessee album, beginning to play out here in the Nashville and filling out the Nashville scene and putting a band together to do that album with you, or did you bring in friends from different places, or?
No, it was all people here. Just started building. I kind of feel like everywhere I've lived, I've sort of ended up, well, like most songwriters probably, building out this sort of circle of people you play with. So I just started building that out. Started with one guy, then a couple guys. You know, my friend Beth, who moved here from Austin also. She's a badass guitar player. She started playing guitar. God, I'm trying to remember now how it all... Yeah, I sort of built up a band. I had a friend here who was a great record producer. We just started talking about making a record. Did a Kickstarter. Made a record. Yeah. In two sessions, we did four. I got a gig. So after I moved here and was kind of stuck with no gig, I got a gig playing guitar with this girl, Natalie Stovall, who's a country singer. And I got a gig playing in her band and opening up her shows. I had made a bass player friend. I brought him on that gig. Then her guitar player, Miguel, ended up being one of my best. Both those two guys are two of my best friends still. So when we had time off with them, I put together the rest of a band and we cut basically an EP's worth of songs. Then I ended up, I didn't want to just put out an EP again. You know, I'd already put out a full length by that point. You know, it was going to be my first thing I'd done here. I wanted it to be more than that. Mm-hmm. So eventually I did the Kickstarter, and we ended up cutting another seven or eight songs. And then eventually it kind of gelled into a record, full record. Tennessee, yeah.
And so just from right there to first coming to Nashville, just got a sense of what, you know, what brought you here. Just since you've been here, just, I guess, the culture and I guess just how many fish are in the pond. Does it seem like there would be a, just today, would there be a better place to be? Maybe not just for you personally, or like if you had another go at it, mm-hmm. and you were in your early 20s, what town would you look for? I guess is what I'm asking. What town would you move to?
Well, Nashville's a very viable place, you know. I mean, it would all depend what you were wanting to do, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
It really would depend what you want to do. But it's a very fertile ground for singer-songwriters right now. I mean, look at who's here right now. You got Aaron Lee Tashton. Jason Isbell lives here now. Margot Price, she came out of being here. Mm-hmm. John Moreland lives here now.
Yeah, he Sadler came from Vaden. Well, he came from Tulsa.
Came from Tulsa, right. Set up roots here at Sadler Vaden. You know, goes on. Caleb Cottle just moved here. Mm-hmm. Of course, Todd Snyder has been a mainstay here forever. I mean, you have people that have been here long. John Prine lives here.
Yeah.
No shortage of
talent.
Great people. Yeah, people should take chances in life, especially at that age, you know. It's hard to know if it's the right place for you until you go.
Until you get there, yeah.
So you could come here, someone could come to a place like this, and after a while think, this place is, I don't know, the music I'm doing maybe doesn't have a home here. People are open to, places full of musicians are open to any kind of music, because musicians do not care about genre.
Right.
You know, folk singer-songwriters love grunge music. They love hard rock. Mm-hmm. They love EDM.
They might go hip-hop.
They love whatever is good. You know, musicians just love music.
Yeah.
So, and there's a scene here. There's an EDM scene, for sure. There's not a great jazz scene. If you're a jazz musician,
probably go to
looking to build your career, I don't know that it would be the best place. We have one jazz club, and it opened a few years ago,
yeah.
And that's it. Even Austin had a few. That said, things could sprout up. A scene could revolve around what you do, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
You could make the scene.
So I think people should take chances, and if you go somewhere and it's not for you, look, I've done it. This is like my third or fourth place that I've picked mm-hmm. to go. Then you go somewhere else, and life affords you that. I don't think anyone just goes somewhere and it just works out perfectly right when they get there.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a rarity.
Yeah, there are a lot of people here doing it, but that's a good thing, you know. Mm-hmm. It pushes you to be better. There's a lot of... And when there's a scene happening, the world flocks to it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of labels popped up now.
You got Jack White's Third Man moved down here.
Yep.
I think he's still got his place in Detroit, but he's got the place here.
He's set up here, though, now, yeah. Dan Auerbach lives here.
Right, and he's got Easy Eye. Easy Eye sound.
Easy Eye. Roger Cook, great songwriter, lives here. I mean, there's so many. You have things now like Americana Fest, which... Say what you will about it, every radio programmer, label person, booking agency, it's sort of like, well, it's not as big as South by Southwest, it's probably a good thing. They all come here. Yeah, there's a lot of connections to be made here is what I'm saying. And even the ones that aren't here come here at least once a year.
That's a good place to rub elbows.
Good place to rub elbows. But and if it gets too much so, then... people start moving elsewhere, you know. I mean, at a certain point, it's like a housing bubble. Eventually, it's going to burst. And eventually, yeah. It gets watered down. And eventually, the vitality of it just starts seeping out and going, you know, elsewhere.
So just kind of back to your story, Kickstarter happened. You got the 7 or 8 more songs recorded, mm-hmm. mixed. Did y'all go? You guys take it on the road, or what did that look like?
I did. I put together a road band, and I started working that as hard as I could on the road. It's a lot of weekends, things like that. I did a radio campaign on it that I funded myself, so it was sort of limited. I had a publicity campaign, got a lot of really strong reviews. It did really well in European Americana radio, and it got some play here, but I didn't have the money to do the full radio campaign, nor did I have I toured as much as I could, and then my wife got pregnant, and touring kind of dried up at that point,
yeah.
for the time being. Because, I had to make more money than I was making. But we did tour it, and it charted in Europe. It charted on some of the charts here. And I don't know, how many records people make where they put everything into it and they really believe in it. And it has a lot of people that believe in it. And everything has to go right. Hey, Pally. What you doing? Oh, everything has to go right for things to move to the next level. Like, everything.
Yeah.
You can hear Camilla and Hugo? That's our neighbor kids. I hope everyone can hear my son, but probably not.
Yeah.
He's probably 20 feet away and through a screen. Yeah. Eventually I just had a record I loved. We made promo videos, and eventually I just had a record I loved that I sold for 4 years of my shows. It's basically what it amounted to.
Yeah. And I mean, just with, just life between the records, your son being born, I mean, that definitely had some of my favorite songs off Sin and Redemption. I mean, yeah. He's mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, so,
yeah.
Love You Too Much, and
That's right.
I want to say Virginia Mourn.
Sweet Virginia Mourn.
Yeah. And so, it's definitely... Fatherhood has definitely impacted your songwriting.
Yes, it has. Can't argue with that.
Yeah.
For the better.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, we had a 6-year span between Sin and Redemption and Tennessee?
6-year span, yeah.
And, just between that, more time at the house and finding ways to make more money?
Yep.
Still writing?
Oh yeah, still writing and playing a ton just in town, a couple of residencies. I actually probably played more than ever, but it was all just locally, and it was in Franklin a lot. I had a residency in Franklin for a couple of years at Kimbrough's down there, and writing a ton with Dan Baird, songs coming out on his records. I was actually, it's the thing with, I'm sure any parent will tell you, your productivity becomes compartmentalized, but it's actually, you're probably more productive, or at least I was. I became more, just because the time you have to use more judiciously.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I found myself getting more work. Like I said, songs on Dan's records coming out. People interested in working with, it gave me something more to, how can I put this? You feel like, I felt always that I was working as hard as I possibly could and being as good of an artist as I possibly could and putting everything I have had into it. And I feel like after I had my son, there was more to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there was less time, there was more fuel,
I guess.
So I felt like my songwriting became more urgent. I just feel like there's more at stake in life now, and that's reflective. My productivity became more urgent because there's more at stake in life, and yeah. You know, I guess I became a little more focused on the business end, or at least trying to put a business end together in a more more diligent way. You know, that's yeah. always been a struggle for me. Always focused on writing and playing, and not as much as other people I admire who have had a strong sense of where to take it within themselves, you know, business-wise.
Sure.
I came from the, you know, part of it's...
And I guess business-wise is like keeping it more at home and like keeping in the Franklin area and not trying to do so much outside.
Well, it was that way out of necessity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, the people I grew up loving were not real self-promoters. They were not self-made businessmen, you know. Neil Young, I don't think, had a business plan. Springsteen didn't have a business plan. Patti Smith didn't have a business plan.
Right.
Pete Townsend. Mick Jagger did have a business plan. I feel like most of them... I grew up, you know, watching these, like... awesome talent, these people with these amazing talent, and people just kind of came to Hendrix. I mean, he didn't have a, you know?
Yeah.
And I just always, when I was younger, felt like, if I'm good enough, that'll take care of itself.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the 70s and the 60s, that's probably how it happened.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people got screwed by business hawks. And I think musicians learned from that. That you know what, you gotta formulate that stuff by yourself. And I never did because I didn't see. You know, my role models. That's not how it worked.
Yeah.
You know, and then I think people that I don't know, but it's something I became more aware of. You know. As I went further, and especially as I became a parent all of a sudden.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, there's like a dagger in the middle of your life separating pre and what's going to come now. You know, a line.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know what? This is the beginning of the rest of it. And I gotta think about that stuff more.
Yeah. I like what you said about, you know, just your time usage, you know, after your son was born. It reminds me of what Sam Beam, Iron and Wine, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but after he became a father, I think it was on World Cafe. They were talking to him about it, and he was like, you know, since just having a kid, you know, having that creative time to be creative and to write, has it changed? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So that it comes early in the morning or late at night when everything is still, and he said having that time is few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
But I know if I'm willing to get up at 4 in the morning, I'll have that a lot of time.
You know, the only other time when I had that revelation was back in New York City. I had a structure where I had stuff going on during the day, most days of the week, starting at 7 or 8 a.m. And I realized, this was around the time where I kind of realized, I want to be a great songwriter, and I'm dedicating my life to that now. I'm not focused on guitar in the way I was. I'm going to be a great songwriter. And I started getting up at 4 in the morning, mm-hmm. and we had a little rehearsal place under the place, and I would go down there at 4 or 5 in the morning for a couple hours every morning, and I just started doing that every morning. And that was the time. And I realized I could make a blueprint where I would feel artistically viable if every day I would put a certain amount of time to that and stick with it every day, then the rest of the day would just kind of be the gravy, even though the rest of the day was the whole day.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like, well, I did what I need to do to be me, and the rest is just whatever I gotta do to get to the next day when I do that.
Yeah.
And for years and years and years, that's the way I did it. It wasn't always 4 in the morning, but it definitely built the discipline for it. And that time discipline had started to wane in the years before we had our son, just out of necessity, different things I had to do for work just time that was available, living situation, where, you know, it was different times of day. Some days I wouldn't have the time, and, you know, it definitely started to shore up again in recent years.
Yeah, and just a little bit more into your process as it's matured over the years, not just being a time. Do you find, like, just looking back over the years, just certain memories as they come back, do you find just those, you know, milestones in life as you've matured and you're able to look back, does that help those memories and looking back, or just where does some of the inspiration come from for you?
You mean, do I look back at times in my life and use those as inspiration for...
Yeah. Like, maybe it was a family trip, or it was just, like, something that was just, you handled just, like, totally wrong, and, like, looking back, like, well, I could have handled this differently, or...
Yeah, now everything in my life feels like, now I look at it as a part of the story. So, some memories I look back that seem like great memories at the time, where I feel like, I wish I'd have done that differently.
Yeah.
And... Or I think, if I had done that differently, what would have happened? Or if I did it that way, if things had gone differently, what would have happened? And oftentimes I just kind of base work, you know, songs on characters that maybe lived those lives. You know, I feel like, yeah, I do like to sort of take different versions of my life and have characters, people like the narrator in the song or whatever, who lived that life.
Yeah.
And kind of, that's what it ends up being inspired by.
Yeah, okay.
That's something that's come over time. I don't think I used to do it that way. It used to just be much more like just looking out from my own eyes.
Yeah. Real tunnel vision.
Yeah, but I don't know. There's only so far you can take that.
Yeah. There's only so much to see through that lens.
Your own life is only so interesting. And you know.
Right. Well, man, just to talk a little bit about Sin of Redemption, and then we'll wrap it up. Just kind of talking about what's going on now, which everything for the most part is dead, but just the journey with Sin of Redemption, and it's been out for a year now.
No, it's only been out
four months. Yeah,
End of October.
Yeah,
almost 5 months.
Yeah. Okay.
No, five. Actually, yeah, about 5 months.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. Yeah, it was late last season. Yeah. So just since it dropping and now, just for people tuning in that may not be familiar with you or your music, and just a little bit about that album and just what you had planned for this year for it.
So this album, this is one where I was approached by a producer who wanted to do the record. And I had a friend who ended up co-producing it, who has been working with me on and off for years, trying to make connections on my behalf. And he connected me with Trey Sasser, who is a producer and owned a studio. And Trace was someone I knew because years and years ago in New York City, I randomly saw Will Hoag play one night. I don't know, do you know Will Hoag?
I do, yeah.
They came through town, and Trace was the bass player. And I loved that band, that iteration of the Will Hoag band. It was actually right after Dan Baird left, who I obviously did not know personally at that time.
Yeah.
But it was a great band. And so I remembered Trace. They came through town, I went and saw him again. I didn't meet Trace at the time, but anyway, got to know him here. Trace wanted to make the record. I was excited about that. I had previously wanted to work with Trace, and it just wasn't to be at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So we got Joe Costa on board, who's a great mixing engineer and a great studio engineer in general. And we worked hard on this record. We got amazing people to play on it. Brad Pemberton plays drums on just about all of it, and the whole thing was very thought out. We really workshopped the songs going in ahead of time. I had a lot of songs to pick from because it had been so long, like I said, since I made a record, and I whittled it down to songs I felt really spoke to what I wanted to be singing about now. And then when it came time to actually cutting it, we actually did our best to make it as spontaneous, the performances as spontaneous as possible.
Yeah.
So it was a good blend. Dan came in and played. Leroy Powell and I had, who's in Whiskey Wolves of the West, and he's an ace. He plays on all Dave Cobb's records.
Cool.
Yeah, and we had become friends through meeting it. There used to be a venue here called The Building that was a big scene, and it was actually a place. After I'd been here for a while, I forced myself to ingratiate myself to that scene because a lot of cool writers and singers seem to be hanging out there, and I wanted to be part of that scene, so I just started going and getting to know those guys, and I got to know Leroy, and he ended up producing a couple of songs, and his brother Chris played on them, and we used the tracks from one of those on the record, which came out phenomenal. So it just got kind of pieced together. We got a label, Rockridge, involved in it, and they put it out, which was really great, really cool. So it's something I really, really believe in, this record. Really,
yeah,
believe, man, in it.
I know just our first time meeting over in Memphis, and I mean, you were sharing older songs and then songs off of Sin and Redemption, and just, you know, the lunches with David, I've really been enjoying those.
Thanks, man, that's
those
cool.
Those segments you've been doing, and I think it was on that you were, it's a hard album for me, like, to tell somebody, like, my favorite song off that album. Because it changes almost on a weekly or daily basis as I'm sitting down with it. But for whatever reason, that week it was Long Road to Barstow.
Okay.
And you were sharing a little bit about the story about how a friend of yours, like...
Leroy.
You had it wrote.
Yeah.
But, like, he helped you flesh it out and make it more.
Right.
And that just helped me to dig the song a whole lot more. It took it to a brand new level for me.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think those lunches with David, if y'all haven't seen that, that's on his social media. You can go back and check those out. It's a great way to sit down and get to know David and hear an unplugged version of his songs, you know?
Yeah. I got a new booking agent, and she came up with that idea.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I want to do these, because the Rockridge, they got another artist named George Singleton, who's a great country singer, and he does these weekly things from his Facebook page. And they've been really successful for him, you know, and like just exposure wise. And they've been pushing me to do it, but I was sort of saying, you know, I can't really do it at night because my kid's sleeping, our house is small. If I do it outside, it's dark, and I don't know. And I can sort of do them at lunch, but then it's daytime. And then Emily, who's helping out with booking, she said, she just took that. She's like, you have to do that, and
yeah,
you gotta make it lunch. You gotta start whatever you're gonna have for lunch that day. You gotta show that.
Yeah.
You gotta build it around that. And I was like, well, I don't know about doing a cooking show. It's not really. I love to cook, but I don't know. And she's like, just try it. It's gonna be cool. Trust me. So we did one, and it felt so silly. I just kind of enjoyed it. I was like, here's my sandwich. Here's the hot sauce. I don't know. It's kind of neat.
Yeah, I saw that one. It's like, this is from my favorite place down here. They make a
great
hot sauce.
Right. So
yeah.
Start doing it. I love telling stories about my songs, you know. If there's any song you want to know the story of, I'd be happy to share it. I don't like to just go on without knowing that someone's interested in it.
Yeah, we'll use that. And so just whatever two songs that you wanted to share with us here on the show, we'll take those two.
Well, I the most personal song is I Love You Too Much. Probably. Because... That kind of was written in the wake of having my son, and you know, I never get tired enough of telling the story, which is just that I felt obviously overwhelmed by the love that you have when you have all of a sudden a son, like, or a daughter, and I felt like a lot of people get really scared when they're having a kid, but I was so excited about it. I just wasn't scared at all. I was just like, this is what I want. Why be scared of this?
Yeah.
You know? And it didn't take long before I developed a real fear, but it wasn't for the fear of not being able to be a dad or all the sacrifices that I knew I was going to have to make. It was a fear of all of a sudden not having this, you know? It's like if suddenly you have something more important than anything else you've ever had, you're not really prepared for the fear of losing it, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of people do lose it, you know? They separate from the mom. They don't get to see their kid. You know, God forbid. I mean, there's obviously a lot of worst-case scenarios, but just, you know, people go through life having to live without something they really love. And that was something that I had never confronted before. Mm-hmm. And that song is about that. And so I called it Henry's Song. But it's not like just a song saying, oh, you're my son and I love you almost too much. I mean, that's true. But it was like, I love you too much to handle the notion of not having this. Like, I don't know how to deal with that.
Yeah.
I don't think you ever learn to deal. You learn to live with it. But it's always, you're walking around with a sidecar now in your life. Whereas yeah. before, you're just walking around with yourself. There's people you love, your parents, your wife, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's different when it's sort of like the product of you, and you're the one that has to take care of that person. And the pride you feel in their accomplishments is more than you're ever going to feel in your own accomplishments.
Yeah.
And that's something I'd never confronted either. So that's why that song to me is kind of sad, because I'm looking at it like someone who has to find the wherewithal and the strength to live without something that they love more than themselves, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's the story of that song. And yeah. Long Run to Barstow, well, you know that story. I've told that. That's on the lunch. Yeah. You know, the title track, Sin of Redemption, is kind of a story I just formulated about someone having to, well, just from people I've known and people that you've probably known, and people are born into circumstances where their life is a struggle from the day they're born.
Yeah.
From the structure of their family, from their circumstances, and you have to try to make the good choices in life, even though it's easy to make the wrong choices. And you're gonna make the wrong choices, but you kind of have to have a North Star of, you know, trying to redeem your sins.
Yeah.
Not from a religious standpoint, it's not about that, just about from being strong and trying to see the good. You know, the guy in that story has a sister.
Yeah.
Who always got the love from his parents, and he never got any because his father was resentful of him because, you know, he wanted something else out of him. But he still loved his sister. And he still loved his mother. And I think at the end of the day, he still loves his dad. And, like, that's hard. That is hard to love people around you when you're resentful of them and...
Yeah, what's your line? You say, I caught the end of my love off the end of a baseball bat.
Yeah. I took the brunt of my daddy's broken heart from the end of a baseball bat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty brutal. But I was listening to a lot of Chris Knight at the time, who's, you know, one of the most brutal songwriters in the world. And, you know, that type of writing is effective to me. Like, a lot of... James McMurtry is another one who's from Texas, and that type of writing where you just don't pull punches in people's lives is effective because people live those lives, or people know people that live those lives.
It really grabs you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were mentioning North Star. I mean, I guess the character in that, like, his sister was that North Star.
Right.
I guess, or it was like a sense of comparison. It's like, I'm trying to...
Right.
Trying to do right.
Right. Right. And she was able to go off and build her own life with a family and keep things at arm's length.
Right.
And for whatever reason, this guy just didn't have the facilities to succeed in that as much. Yeah, and there's the whole angle of, like, whenever he goes to see his sister's, you know, husband gets pissed off that he just showed up without announcing it because, you know, they have a kid or they have kids. And, you know,
he just got off on being called uncle.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good song, man.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, man. Well, man, anything else to add or subtract, and we'll walk on out with some music.
You know, I'm
social media, yeah, way to find you and plug you.
Sure, yeah. Well, I'm easy to find on the social media, davidneubold.com. The Facebook is /DavidNewbold. The Instagram is /DavidNewbold. I'm looking to be out on the road. Well, when this whole thing clears up, which, you know, we could talk about that for a minute too. I mean,
yeah,
it's honestly a nice little detour talking about the way life has been normally and the way it'll hopefully be again. But, you know, we're in a lockdown right now of unparalleled proportions, and, you know, I don't know when people are going to be out touring again. I'm making the plans with the booking, and I'm talking to people about planning, you know, from a management standpoint, planning what we're going to do into next year and this year. But gosh, it's hard to even plan, because
I'm telling you, I mean, March is gone. April, like, all I've seen for, you know, a lot of the singer-songwriters and bands that I follow, it's TBD or it's already out. May is halfway out. And so, I mean, what do you do? You can't really, I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think everybody is just flailing, trying to make predictions. But, I mean, based on what I've seen, I think as far as touring, I think the summer's probably out. I think fall is anybody's guess. It really depends on how we as a society act in the next several weeks. With regards to the distancing and trying to keep the spread minimal, but until there's a cure, which is well into next year,
right?
You know, I think it's going to be a part of our lives till then. So, you know, but I was talking to my wife about this last night, and I think one silver lining is that we're really all going to see the creativity that humans are capable of, because, you know, in all fields, what are people going to do now? You got to do something. You know, everyone's got to find a way to not be homeless and not pay the bills and not raise their kids. And I mean, you know, what, in 2 weeks, all of a sudden, there's been extremely creative live streaming avenues people are coming up with.
They have.
You know, that's cool for now. That's definitely seems to be working for some people. I'm actually doing one tonight on a platform called Zoom with 15 other artists, and we're all doing 15-minute segments, and, you know.
Had the virtual tip jar, and...
Well, this one's got a $5...
Oh, okay.
It's a $5 thing, and that gets split between half between the artists and half between businesses or charities of their choice. Yeah, the virtual tip jars, I mean, I think it's going to be a lot of that stuff for now, but I think, you know, that's not... People are going to come up with new ways, really creative ways. And when this is all over, I think it's an industry that will have even more avenues for people to succeed, because we're going to come up with them because we have to.
Yeah.
You know? So that's it. I'm going to be out trying to find my way in this, and I got people helping that we're going to try to come up with ways, and then hopefully by the fall I'll be out on the road more, taking this album. I mean, it's still a new record, and I mean, everybody's just, I mean, every product, you know, it's like everything's on hold. But I think all records that come out, I think a lot of people are going to be working records that aren't brand new by the time they're able to get out and tour again. because it's the first time they're going to be able to take them to places other than where they live, mm-hmm. other than via media, social media. Yeah. But playing live is always going to be the thing, because that's the way, you know, that's the way that you fall in love with somebody, is you go see them. You like the records. You can fall in love with a record. But, I mean, you go see someone live and make the connection, and you're a fan for life. Yep. And I don't see how that's going to change.
Right. And I could see it possibly happen over a live stream. I don't, though, you know?
Like, to a degree.
It's a way for me to connect with you as a fan already. It's a way to, like, during this time, you know, it's like, okay, I can still, he's not out, you know, in Alabama or Mississippi playing tonight, but I can see him via Facebook or Zoom. You know?
You know, when I lived in Austin, I used to go almost every week to the Continental Club on Wednesday nights and see John D. Graham and James McMurtry. And I was never sick of it, because it was in the moment every time, and it was a lot of the same songs every week, but it just got better. And now I watch those guys on live stream, and it's satisfying. But I think, man, I really wish I was seeing them in a venue.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's going to ever go see a band in a venue and think, this is really cool, but I really wish I was at home watching it on my phone.
Right.
You know?
Right. You're not going to have, but I mean, it's the best means that you can do right now with social distances. And so, like, the main thing that I've been pushing with listeners is the best way that you can do right now for those musicians and bands and artists that you love is if they have merchandise, if they have albums, mm-hmm. whatever they have, buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they have that you like, support them.
That's the truth, you know, but that's
and try to go around the label, like go right. straight to them if mm-hmm. you can.
Yeah, and all my albums are on my website. You can buy them directly. Sin and Redemption's the only one with any other outlet that's been put out by anyone other than myself. But, you know, that's a lot to ask of people now, too, because no one knows where their income's coming from.
Right.
So, you know, I encourage people to support their artists, but I encourage people to support their families.
Yeah.
You know, but one thing you can do for free, if you can't buy product, or if you can now, but in 2 months you can't, is stream them and share it with your friends. Because if it goes on playlists, you know, numbers mean a lot. It used to be sales numbers meant a lot. Now streaming numbers mean a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about bridging the gap until people can work more and people can buy more and people can spend more and people can play out more. And, mm-hmm. You know, but listening to music is free. Telling your friends about it's free. Sharing it on playlists and Spotify is essentially free. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you can support it and buy people's merchandise, buy their t-shirts, buy their records, that's obviously the best. That's obviously the best thing you can do right now.
Right.
But, you know, as you can.
Yeah, at times it's hard right now.
Yeah.
Well, brother, you ready to play a song?
I'd love to, man.
How old is that guitar, man?
It's a 1958 or 59. The serial number was traced to one of those 2 years. I've had it for... I bought this in New York not long before I moved to Austin. So I've had it for... I've had it for probably 20 years now. If I ever lost this, I'd probably write another song like I Love You Too Much. All right, well, this is called Love You Too Much. I think I love you too much. I paint your face with a needle and brush. I walk the streets all alone at dusk. I think I love you too much. I don't know what I'm gonna do.
can't let go. It's just the truth. To find your way in a world untrue, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I didn't know how anyone could talk so loud and not be understood. Hold so tight, it don't do no good. I didn't know how anyone could. There ain't nobody who wants to walk on their own once their heart's been taken to see. I've got these shoes and the water's close. Your heart still beats in time with me. I think I'm gonna take a long ride. Remember how I felt such pride the day that you appeared in front of my eyes. I'm gonna take a long ride. Wants to walk on their own once their heart's been taken to see. I've got these shoes and the water's close. Your heart still beats in time with me. I think I love you too much. Well, I paint your face. Up the streets all alone at dusk. I think I love you too much. I walk the streets all alone at dusk. I think I love you too.
Thanks for having me on your podcast and coming all the way up here for it.
Yeah, man.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.